certain benefit. We went around this mountain, we were under cabin fire all the way around, and we got down to the gap of Mount Nicholson here in Canada. And then we got very heavy shelling there, and a few guys got wounded, and then we got down here to one that's around the mountain. And down here, you could just see the Japs, they were just swarming around in hundreds. And we had to go down this road, and we got in the corner there, and they started firing on us, and we went up in the rocks, and then they started with the artillery on us, you know, small field guns, so we had to get out of there, and hitting that rock, so they just shot us. We went down around the bend, and we got down there, and as the officer told us, any time the fire got too hot to return, well, then we got around the bend, okay, and I remember I dropped a revolver out of my pocket, and one guy was stupid enough to stop and pick it up when we were under heavy fire, and he gave it to me later. So we got down there and took up our positions, and two of our guys, we attacked the place. They told us that in this police station there was 200 Japs or Amit or something. So then we wondered about 20 of us went down, and it turned out there was more like about 300 or 400 of us. And then the major got wounded, and the lieutenant got wounded, and two of the guys that were taken prisoner were wounded, and one or two other guys killed. I used to get now, like in the heat of battle like that. And then we were met up with some Royal Scots, and we stayed there all the next day. And by evening, we were down to, I think, two clips for the burn guns. And this Captain Ford, he was a very brave man. He just told us there was no use staying any longer because we were right low in ammunition. So we withdrew and went to their headquarters for the night, which wasn't too far around the mountain. But we were wet and cold because it had rained very heavy that evening. And they gave us a good drink of rum, which was quite appropriate for the time. And the next morning, the colonel in charge of the Royal Scots told us to go back to our own unit then. So we left there and went back and joined up the own bunch. I remember one officer there, he was a big yellow bastard, I don't care who's here, but one guy got left us with his platoon and gone back, and he said we'd all been wiped out. And we walked in this morning, he's quite surprised. Oh, he said, I thought you were all dead. And I remarked, I said, no, we're very much alive. So we picked up some more ammunition, and then we went back to our original pillbox. And here a British major by the name of Major Giles has taken it over. And he's got a few of our old army personnel that, you know, they were more or less good for just flunky jobs, or no good for combat, and he had them around. And we asked this old gentleman we call C.N.R. Lewis, because he worked for the railroad, if they had any rum. And he says, sure, and he picks the major's gallon bottle of rum up. And there's 13 of us, we all have a drink of it. And the major was very mad, but he didn't say anything, because we'd been in action a couple of days. So I imagine when we left, though, he had a lot to say. And which brings me, I was reading a book about him. He was woke up and he told that we were at war. That's when the Japanese struck me, and he says, I know, with a chap named Hitler, frightful type. That was his retort. And the fellow says, no, we're at war with Japan. So they told him to go and do something, to command the Navy or the Army. Well, he says, nothing to command. Well, he said, go and find something, get out of my hair. So anyway, we had his rum, and then we left there, and we took up positions on Mount Cameron and Bennett's Hill. And on those, in the daytime, you were subject to very heavy attack. You get like these small mortars or big artillery, and then planes come over. You know, you never knew what to expect. And then at night, you got these cruisers sneak in, and they would let go before you'd even know they were there. And we were on there for a few days. Then we were told that they moved us back here to protect this reservoir here. There was a footbridge across. And that's where our line pretty well remained, right up to the end. We were still holding our line on Christmas Day. We were there under very heavy fire all day. But when we were on Bennett's Hill and Cameron, in one instant, I remember at night, a Japanese bomber came in just about six. There was a little ammunition ship there, and they were trying to hit it. Well, he hit high on the hill on the edge of a cemetery, and the bomb hit the cemetery, the terrorist in the hill. It hit and skidded down, and it did actually hit this ammunition barge and blow it up. But the plane, he couldn't pull out fast enough, and we all poured machine gun and rifle fire, and he came down and went out in the harbor about a mile and crashed. And this torpedo boat went out, and they told us that he just riddled like the top of a pepper pot, this bomber. So we at least had the pleasure without just rifle fire and machine gun fire shooting this one plane down.
Did you have any anti-aircraft protection?
Pardon?
Did you have any anti-aircraft
protection? Oh, the British had a few guns, but I never saw them shoot anyone. You know,
you'd see the shells explode and the plane would be from here to Eaton. But I never actually thought to shoot a plane down with them, though some of them did in some places.
What about did you have any artillery covered to them?
Well, they had some of them. The Indian regiment did have some artillery, see. And they did have one gun there that was firing right up the last thing. They ran out of ammunition. But the big guns at Stanley, which could have raised havoc from 12 miles from away, they couldn't turn them around. They'd only traverse 90 degrees each way, like south. You couldn't swing them around to fire north.
Yet the British command knew that the Japanese were going to attack at almost any time.
Yes, but they always figured that an invasion would come from the sea. So while we're still at Christmas Day, we're at the reservoir, we're still holding the positions. They never pushed it out of the sea. And Christmas Day, I remember there was 13 of us. We were low in water, and my friend Jack Hardy, he works in Eaton, he lives out here someplace by the shopping center in St. Boniface there. We just went down the spring to get some water, and we heard the most ungodly noise, and I just looked up, and I could see this object coming end over end, and it was one of these big artillery shells that had hit the gap, and it hadn't gone off, and it was coming tumbling. And I just said to Jack, hit the dirt, and we just hit it in the bank, and it fell down about 10 feet over the bank from us. But luckily, it didn't explode, or we'd have both been killed. Well, we got some water, and we went back to our position. And for Christmas dinner, remember, there were 13 of us. We had bully beef and hardtack, and a sergeant by the name of Charlie Bamondine, he had a sealer of marmalade. And we each had a spoon of marmalade on a biscuit. That was our Christmas dinner. And later that afternoon, we sat up on the hill, we saw this white flag go up, and some didn't know what it was, and someone said, let's shoot at it, and he started to say, no, you better not, we better wait and see, and we saw more of them going up, and then finally a sergeant, a little Frenchman named Berard, he came down and he told us that the war was definitely over and to destroy our weapons. Well, you know, naturally, you, as an awful shock, you could hardly believe it, though you knew you were fighting pretty a tough battle all the way through, so we destroyed everything we could, and we kept, myself, I had a 38 revolver, which I kept, 20 rounds of ammunition, and a couple of grenades, and some of the other fellows did likewise, because we didn't know what we might run into. And we were told then that to either stay there, or wait till the Japanese come, or we could go back behind here, some place with a monastery up here. Up around, there was a monastery around the hills here somewhere in this area. So we went there, and there was army rations and that there, so we stayed all that night and nothing happened, and the next day, you know, you look around and think, well, it'd be pretty nice if you get to the mainland, you might escape, but you know, and then there was planes flying around all day long, it'd just be impossible. So at 4 o'clock that afternoon, a dispatch rider, one of our boys, came down and told us, anyone that was there, they didn't know how many of us were there, to come up to the Peak Mansion up here on the hill. I know where these Peak Mansions, they're right up on the high part there anyway. So we destroyed these revolvers and stuff away then, and we picked up some rations and clothing and stuff to have. So we met a lot of the boys we hadn't seen for a while. You didn't know who'd been dead or killed or what, you know, or taken prisoner. And so we had something to eat, and then that night a truckload of guards came along and they took us up to what they called a house on the Peak Mansion. I don't know where they put them all, but they only put about 50 of us in this one house, and they didn't bother us. We went to, I'd say 5 or 6 city blocks of Japanese soldiers. I don't think they even had rifles with them. I think, you know, they were just resting along the roads about 6 deep each side. They didn't bother. And they put us in this house. And I remember we were prowling around. It had been ransacked to a certain extent downstairs. Well, I remember finding a can of Maxwell House coffee and some sugar, which I kept. And then my friend and I, Cecil Larrabee, he was my closest partner. He eventually died. But we went upstairs and we opened a closet and we found 72 bottles of Scotch whiskey and 48 bottles of gin. So, I mean, we spent a pretty comfortable night, needless to say. And the next morning, I've got to rely on my notes now to keep my notes. The next morning, they decided to move us out of there, and they marched us down to the University of Hong Kong. Well, it had all been wrecked. The typewriters had been thrown in piles and gasoline put over them and burned. And we stayed there all day in the rain, and They finally had machine guns set all around us. They finally agreed to let us go and get some water. And then the next morning, they marched us down to the British Army barracks, Victoria Barracks. They'd been heavily damaged by bombs and artillery fire, but they were evident there was ample rations around there, because my friend and I, we picked up 23 cans of milk, and I picked up oatmeal, you know, some canned rations, like McConaughey vegetable stew and that, and beans and stuff. And when we left there, we were both carrying in the neighborhood, I'd say, about 60 to 70 pounds of rations, because we had been told by our Japanese that we were going to be marched 300 miles inland from when we got across to the other side. Where, I don't know, but anyway, so we thought we might as well have lots of rations. So anyway, on the 30th of January, on the 30th of December, rather, they took us across to Shamshapu. And instead of marching straight up to Shamshapu, some guys got a bright idea, we would go to this camp over here. So we marched away over there and then had to come back here. And we actually went about 5 or 6 miles out of our way to carry all this. And when we got there, we were really, if we hadn't been in good shape from running up and down hill, we couldn't have stood it. Well, they just kept us there a short time. And well, the month we were there, at the end of January, we never had any proper meals. I remember they took an old gasoline barrel and set it on stones and stuck a crowbar through the top of it to lift it on and off, and they just threw rice and greens and that, boiled it all up into slop. And at first some of the fellows wouldn't eat it, you know, but the next thing you know, it was just a continual line around till the barrel was empty. And some of us had like bulk rice now to get it, and we couldn't like cook it out then. And there was lots of people who, you know, like some of them had been taken prisoner, well, the Japs had stripped them of everything. They had nothing. They came into camp with nothing, whereas we had not been searched at all. I could have taken out guns or anything in camp. They never searched us at all. Everything we had, they never searched us at all. We'd have taken with barrels or anything. Some of the guys would have been like taken prisoner in the fighting, or have been taken prisoner right in the near proximity of the time. They were stripped of everything: wristwatches, pens, or some of them even had their shoes taken. So arms like that, like you shared with them, then the Chinese came around the fences selling us our own, you know, can of bully beef for a dollar, Makahai $1, that means their girlfriend, if you want a girlfriend for a dollar, fine, but they were selling you all this stuff. Well, sometimes the guys would grab it on them, or the Chinaman would grab you a dollar, neither one would get anything, but sometimes the Jap guards would see that you got your can of beef, and the other guy got his dollar. And I remember one incident where they were selling sugar, you know, they rolled up like that in the paper, about, oh, it was a small teacup full, and it was about half sand. And this Japanese sentry made this Chinaman eat it. He wasn't going to eat it, he just poked his bayonet in and eat it, and he'd choke on it, and the wise thing, he'd point his bayonet, and he finally ate it all. That was his punishment for selling sand mixed with sugar for weight. Well, we stayed there until the 30th of January then, and then we moved back to North Point. It was miserable weather there, cold and rainy, and we stayed there until September 1942, that same year. But all through the summer, like malnutrition was beginning to show. People were getting these sore mouths and that, and blisters, and they were getting dysentery, and eyesight was failing and like that, and they were starting to die then. And then in September, they moved us back to the mainland. They sent this British draft at that time, remember they sunk the Lisbon Maru? The draft that left there on that, they made room, so that's how we came to go over to the camp then, because they had left. Well, things were pretty rough then. We had started from North Point working over at the airport, and then we went over to Shamshapu. Some of the guys still got out like work at the airport, but we walked right into a dip epidemic, and the men were dying at 8 to nothing. It was quite common for 8 a day to be carried out dead. And they were buried, then put a little wooden cross on them, and when he went back the next day, the Chinese would have dug the corpse up, taken the blanket that he was rolled up in like a sausage, and taken the wooden cross, so he didn't know where anybody was. And I remember we got isolated. I didn't have dip, I was a carrier, and I got isolated, and I got stuck in a place where we used to eat garlic and everything to try and chase it away. And we eventually got stuck out of there, and we got put into these huts. They didn't have windows. The Chinese, like when the war was on, they literally ransacked everything, lockers, everything they could get, they took. And we were put in these huts, about 50 men or more to one of this, supposed to be a hospital. And then in late in 40 October, we had our first American air raid from, I forget the place in China now, Chongqing, had our first raid. Well, that raid, was a little morale building. And shortly after that, we got bulk Red Cross supplies, and we also got an individual parcel each. Now, the bulk consisted of, dried fruits and lots of bully beef stuff that they put in stew and stuff. But you got your private box, you had a pudding, bacon, a big bar of chocolate, soap, a can of salmon, or biscuits, things of that nature, and sugar. And then they gave us, that winter there was not too much to do. I mean, most of us were pretty sick. That I had in January 43, I had dysentery and malaria, then right down to 97 pounds. Well, I was about 160 when I was taking prisons. Of course, then, you were really in good shape, because you've been running around up and down hills and that. And then they got big-hearted, and on the Emperor's birthday, they gave us another parcel. Well, from then on, it was pretty lean all summer. We were just eating, you'd get fish that was rotten, you'd just get water reeds enough to put in soup, or flour was full of bugs and weevils and that. And rice, there was a lot of rice, but it was, it was a damn poor quality. You wouldn't feed it to pigs, would you?
Polished rice?
No, it was, it was white, but it was very poor quality. It had worms and grit and stuff in it. It wasn't a good, clean variety of rice. Well, then in August, early August or late July and August, they decided to pick the draft out. So they picked out 500 Canadians and British, and we left on the 15th of August. And we landed in Formosa on the 18th, and we stayed there 10 days in the harbor. 500 of us cramped up in a ship, and yet most of you were like this. You couldn't stretch out. You were in the holes back and forth. And they did let us come up and dark light and have a shower off of the holes. And remember, we had stool tests. They had to stand there along the rail with your bare backside sticking out. And I remember these Japanese nurses down on the little barges below there, all grinning from ear to ear. Their skinny old backsides, and seeing them sticking these things out of their backside. And they allowed us to buy some cigarettes and some bananas and stuff. Well, the bananas, we didn't get too many, and we get a basket of rice. So you just bring a basket of rice down in the hole, and you served it out as far as it went, and that was it. And you had one bucket for urination purposes and that, and they just had the same in other. So all we got of bananas was an odd slice of it here and there mixed through the rice. Well, we left there on the 28th, and then we got out and they put the planks over the holes and they tied them down with tarps. Well, that didn't give you a very nice feeling when you, like American submarines, were operating in the area. But anyway, we landed in Kobe Airport on the 1st of September, Kobe Harbor, rather, on the 1st of September. And we were met there by Japanese of all sorts and size, their medals and everything on. And they lined us up and, like my friend, he maybe had my blanket, I maybe have a pair of his pants, and you carry each other's stuff, so they just walk back in line, and okay, that cut the grass, so you have my blanket, I couldn't have it, you went away with my blanket, I went away with something of yours, you know, it may cause more hardships, because things you'd shared together you didn't have. Well, we were put on a streetcar then, and they were very good streetcars, better than anything I've ever seen here, and we were taken someplace where there were some American prisoners, and we spent the night there. And I remember hearing this broad English voice. I looked around, and here's two Japanese officers who had been educated in Oxford, and they were very English. And they told us that if we behaved ourselves, that we'd be told we'd be well treated. Well, we were that night. They were very good to us. But they were just utterly astounded that we had matches. And we found a little box of matches. Because after the Doolittle raid, there were strict blackouts every night. But they took the matches away from us, and they gave us tea, and then the next morning they gave us breakfast and a little box of rice and fish and pickled radish, kind of. They call them daikons. They're like a big white radish, and they pickle them. And we had three little buns. That was our food to go to the camp the next day, to this Oyama. So we took the train out of there the next day, and very pretty. Like, you go up the valley, through a tunnel, and down the other side leads out. And it's very beautiful. It's kind of like Ireland in that sense, the valley. And anyway, we got to this camp, and it had been built in the west. It was grass that high, everything had grown up because it was on reclaimed land. So we had to clean the place up and get everything in order. And then, we all had a medical. Well, I don't know what the heck happened. They decided that they had to put men out to work, so they took Dr. Moiser. He was a Japanese, very noisy. He'd been educated in Germany, and you could hear him all over camp yelling and hollering. And he'd come and used to step up in the last mass, and he'd sit there cross-legged with a big, long stethoscope. It was fall out of his ears, and he'd switch them around, and yap on your heart, and he'd be yapping to you someone else. And I don't know if you ever heard a word he said, but he examined us all, and for some reason, I don't know why, he stuck me in the hospital. And the first work party went out on the 9th of September. So from then till the 1st of March, of those 200 men, 40 were dead on the 1st of March.
What were the work parties
doing? Well, we were working in the, right near the camp. We had a nickel factory. But this ore, it was just like black coal dust and weighed like lead. It's come in barges, and you'd have to unload it in a pile. And then later, it would be loaded on little trucks on a small little railway gauge rail, or small, and it'd be taken up to the factory by a small locomotive. But we used to have to winch it around a curve to get to the locomotive, and sometimes the guys would just step on the cable and get under the ties and upset the whole works. Well, that went over a few times, but then after that, it didn't matter what the conditions were, we had to fix it before we'd go home, so we quit doing it. Then when you got it up the factory, it had to, you know, fed into the refinery. Then the more black, it came out in the sludge. You'd have to empty these sludge pools, and it was like emptying molasses. And you'd dig down, and all of a sudden it'd just slide, and you could get inundated. Well, we did have one guy killed with it once, the way he got out on the ore pile, the way just a big slide came down. And the others used to go up the valley about 10 miles on this lousy little railway to an open copper mine, you know, just open stripping on the hillsides. And it took about an hour to go each way, and they'd be cold and wet. You'd have wet snow that deep today and about that much tomorrow, and they just had running shoes, and they'd go to work in wet feet, and they'd have pneumonia and that, and dysentery, diarrhea, and that. Well, they just died like flies, so it's no excuse. Well, on the 1st of March, this other Japanese Dr. Maru came in, and at that time, another draft had just come in from Hong Kong with some Canadians and British. So he was going to examine the men, and they called a bunch, and they all stripped you naked. And he just saw two or three, and he just said, get dressed. And he just said, okay. And I'm going to put those 100 men on complete rest and full rations. If you weren't working, you see, you only got half rations. It wouldn't matter if you worked 100 days in a row and were sick one day, half rations. Or if you got a few cigarettes, you wouldn't get them. So he put them on full rest and full rations. And those men died after that, but not in the proportion to what they were dying.
What was the food like in this camp?
Well, at the beginning it wasn't bad. When we first went there, you got a lot of things. You got pumpkins chopped up in stew. It wasn't bad, you know. And you got beans and everything like that. And the rice was very good quality rice, but you didn't get too much of it. You got your little ration, and that was it. And they would supplement it with rolled barley and beans, and sometimes we got beef diced up in a stew, and occasionally we used to get these little sprats, little fish fried in coconut oil, which gave them a kind of a sweet taste. Well, it's very good. And you got bean curd and soy sauce, things like that. It wasn't too bad for a while, but then all of a sudden they just seemed to get mean. We were even getting an issue of cigarettes there about every 2 weeks for a while. But then they just turned mean, and anything went. They didn't care. We had pumpkin vines in stew. We had potato tops in stew. We had fish skeletons in stew. Crap, something just so like a fish laying out in the rock. And you couldn't even eat it. It just made your gut revolt even trying to eat it. And it just went from bad to rotten. But at Christmas time, they did, in Christmas 43, they gave us a pretty good Christmas, everything they did. But then a lot of the guys, you know, made pigs of themselves. And got sick and dysentery and stuff worse than diarrhea, and they couldn't go out to work. Well, that made them very mad. And everything they could confiscate in the line of food they had, they took it away from them. You see, some people, they realize if you had so much food, well, have a little today, a little tomorrow, and you know, no use eating it all today and napping up, but a lot of them, you know, they had to just eat it and make pigs of themselves, which is kind of hard to understand, easy to understand too when they're starving. So after that, I mean, they were just plain miserable. There's no other word for it. And then we had this English medical sergeant and one of our own sergeants here that collaborated them a lot, which didn't help too much. And then the first doctor that came into the camp was this Dr. Stenning, an Australian. He'd been on an Australian destroyer, HMS Perth, and the Japanese sank it, and they picked him up as a prisoner. He came to the camp in October 43, and he stayed till June 44. Well, he did everything he could, but they, you know, they only had limited medicine. There wasn't too much he could do. And then he was succeeded by this Major Beadnell, and he stayed till the end of the war. And then in November 44, and they decided they had to send some of the camp to a hospital in Ichioka near Kobe. This is just a front for the Red Cross. So at that time, I had a chronic case of diarrhea. I've downed about 105 or 6 pounds. And so I was one of the ones that went. And then after being there about a week, said we had bread and we had better rations. We got bread and that. And as soon as you got the bread, well, it cleared up right away. But in any case, when I first went there, they put me up on this duplex like this put on the site before, and there's a lot of these Javanese, and after the day were just rotten with tuberculosis, hemorrhaging, everything. And that's where I picked up tuberculosis. At least it's as good a place anyway, I get paid. But I stayed there, and then after I was put downstairs, as soon as my diarrhea cleaned up, they put us working in the kitchen, like not in the kitchen, but outside. We chopped wood and stuff like that for the. And they used to bring in bones from horses and mules. We used to break them up, you know, so the cooks could boil them, but we used to sometimes steal some of the little bits of marrow on them, and you put it on hot rice, like it made it greasy. Well, after we, I think that we all got up to about 115 pounds, and they took us off that, and they put another bunch in. Well, in that time, we went under heavy bombings all the time. In November, they started the American reconnaissance planes coming over in November. And we had, like, nuisance raids put in there all the time. You know, planes would come in from a high altitude with their motor shut off and let a shower of heavy bombs go, and then they'd be gone before you'd ever get a searchlight or anything. But to give you an example of what the bombing raids were like, in February 1945, we had 54 raids in 28 days. And, you know, Osaka, that's like St. Boniface, Winnipeg, so to speak, but I think they're about 20 or 30 miles apart. In March 45, when I was there, they attacked all these waves of B-29s, and they burned 17 square miles out one night with incendiary bombs. We are 20 or 30 miles away, and you could read by the light of it. And a day or two later, this reconnaissance plane came over, and that night we got it. They started at 12 at night, and they bombed steady with these B-29s, wave after wave, till 6 the next morning. And I read the paper. We used to have a paper smuggled into the hospital. And the Japanese admitted that they burned 11 square miles that night. They just devastated everything. Ending up burning shrapnel and that. You could go out and pick it up like you could pick gravel up from bombs and that, everything like that, but these incendiary bombs. And with a gun up on the hill, a 5-inch anti-aircraft, and it was firing too. And those, you know, when they'd explode in the air, your pieces come down, you get them to bash off the roof. And then in the morning, they followed that up with carrier raids. And one day we saw three of these little Zeros go after a B-29. A B-29 shot two of them down. We never saw what happened. See, they had 11 50 caliber Brownies you could converge on one target. But we never did see what the third one happened. The second one, he was up about 5 miles, and he just came straight down about half a mile from the bay, and the scream of the thing coming down, it would just make you just feel goose pimples all up your back.
You can see these planes near fairly well?
Oh, yeah, you see the streamers. You see the coming, you see the. You go off, see a B-29 going daytime, you see this white scene, but they couldn't reach them with that. The only time they get them is they came down for low-level bombing when they come down to about 4 to 5,000 feet at night. You see, and they'd go in and they'd drop a string of incendiaries. The next plane would just pass that, and he'd look just like a herringbone. Just follow on and on. You had everything was blazing in front. And he'd sit in Osaka there, and they had that big 17-square-mile, that the asphalt was actually flowing in places from the heat of it. Well, anyway, to get back to the preamble here, in the spring of 45, I went back to the camp again at Oyama, and by that time, a bunch of American prisoners came from these dockyards. You see, they'd fed them good because it was heavy work, and they were in good shape. They were on the somewhere around 160, 70, 80 in that. And when they came to the camp there, they were unloading ships from Korea. They were coming across, you know, where's that little map? Coming across all the time from Korea with beans and peanut oil and stuff, because we were situated in about that hook there. And they were unloading these ships all the time. And we used to trade them rice for beans. They were sick of rice, and we were starving, sick of beans, rather, and we were starving for rice. So we used to trade them our rice for the beans all the time. Well, all summer long, we messed around on odd jobs, working in gardens, like all their lavatory excretion was carried out in buckets. You had a pole on your shoulder to mine. We had a bucket dangling in the middle. You either put it right on the garden or in a sump for it to use later on. And different things went out. You moved lumber and you unloaded ore and this, that, and everything, you know. But they never seemed to be any different in their attitude at any time, you know. Like one of their pet tricks would be a roll call. If you were supposed to take a roll call today and you had to be out of camp, well, someone else would take it. But if they came back at 4 o'clock in the morning, they'd push the buzzer and everyone would have to assemble. 10 minutes later, then when you got back, they might just decide they made a mistake and you'd all get out again. Well, when poor slobs had to get up in the morning and go to work and things like that, it didn't do them any good for their sleep. Or if they had some little whim, they might stand them to attention for an hour. You know, it's senseless things like that they would do. As far as, I mean, they were merciless with their own people, and they didn't, naturally, you couldn't expect any better treatment from them. Well, on July 30th, so we had a big raid that day, we were going out to work in the morning, these carrier planes, and they bombed us all day long at will. And so we just sat around and watched them, and they'd come in, and they would level off on the water, and they'd go around the bend and get these ships in the harbor, and just skip bomb them. And I think one day they sunk 11 ships there, not 11, about 7, and they lost one plane in a whole day's bombing, and two of the guys were killed for unloading the ships. And that night when they lined up, this Japanese sergeant, he says, "How many are glad you had a raid today?" And of course, everyone puts their hands up. And then he said, "How many are glad two men got killed?" Well, nobody put their hands up, and that made him mad. So he couldn't do anything about it anyway. So anyway, the end of the war came along, and then we were supposed to go to work this next day, and we heard the war was over, and then they came in that night, and they said, "Everybody out to work tomorrow," and I thought, uh-oh. And later on, they came along, and they said, "No work tomorrow," and every person would get an issue of cigarettes. Well, we knew there was something wrong then. And the camp commandant called us out and told us the war was all over. We were enemies today and friends tomorrow, etc. This didn't mean much. Well, while we were in the camp after the war, we didn't leave the camp the 9th of September. Actually, we were 2 years to the day as we left from the camp. But these B-29s came in and they just literally showered us. They were stupid to a large extent. They hit buildings with great big shoot loads, some of them half as big as this kitchen. Just bashed buildings in. You get cans of ketchup, pizzas, everything like that. Gasoline drums loaded with stuff. Well, these slate roofs, some of them were slate, some of them were tin. And in the barracks I was in, I remember sitting where I sat, it was on the studs were on cement about that thick, and I went outside for something, and I just got across the parade ground when we lined them up for roll call and that, and this carrier came in, and he was dropping little bags of gunny sacks of coffee or something, and it hit the slate above us, just we ducked under the door. And when I went back to where I was sitting, there was a hole in the ground, you could put that stove in there. They dropped a load right through the roof. But I mean, if I had stayed there, I wouldn't be there right now. And I remember a carrier plane, he had to show off. He brought a bag about the height full of canned coffee. He dropped it and rolled it right in the kitchen door. From about 50, just about 50 feet high, he came into one of these grooming Hellcats. The weather was after that, but it was a nice job, and he put it in there. One guy got his head cracked a bit. The only real casualty was found two dead rats. But they hit the hospital and several different places like that. Anyway, we left there on the 9th and went to Yokohama and opposite Tokyo Bay there. Well, harbor, I mean, it's a sight to see them, the ships, and not just a mass of ships. Battleships, cruisers, destroyers, aircraft carriers. So you could hardly imagine.
How did you get to Yokohama?
We took a train.
Did you go on your own initiative?
No, we were like told this morning we would catch the train. Well, they sent some communications before that they were to provide such service, we were told about 9 o'clock on the 9th we would catch the train. I don't know how it was done. There was some dispatch riders sitting or something. I know there was a couple of American dispatch riders came along or something. But anyway, it took us from 9 that morning until 10 the next morning to get to Yokohama. But all along the way, the devastation, we saw people not by the hundreds, but literally by the thousands along river banks, not under rock ledges. Not, they're just homeless. And big cities, if we're big cities, they were just devastated. There was nothing. You'd see a few bits of tin and just piled up like that, people in them. I tried to get out of the rain and stuff like that. And when we went to Kobe and places like that, where those smokestacks were used to stand up just by the hundreds, everything, it was just an odd one here and there. They just completely bombed it right out. Well, when we got to Yokohama, we got off the train and went to a decontamination center. Well, most of us were cleaned up. I mean, more you try to keep clean, but we wouldn't have our hair cut off. Right? So this American officer said, well, he said, just drop your pants, and I'll give you a couple of flits with a gun, like delouse you or something. He says, you look clean enough to me. So we did that, Jack Hardy and I. And then we went off looking, we thought we might find some souvenirs, swords or something. And when we came back there, everything was closed up and there wasn't a soul around. So we got on an American. It had been a tank ship, but it had been converted to a hospital, and the guy's along, he's going to throw us off. Well, we told him we had no place to stay. Well, he said, oh, I guess you can stay here for the night. He said, but be off in the morning. So we went off in the morning, and we ran into some American sailors, and they took us over onto the USS Colorado, a 45,000-ton battleship. Well, we spent several days on there and had a real good time, turkey dinners and everything. They gave us paper to write home. They said, don't worry about censoring. This won't be censored. So we wrote letters home. And funny little incident, I remember there, I bought a tin of nuts there and I scratched the date on it, the 14th of September, I believe. And my friend, Jack Hardy, he still has it in his kit bag. This little can of cashew nuts, we never opened it. Whether they'd be any good or not, I don't know. I told him we should someday donate it and let the last Hong Kong survivor eat. Well, we were taken off this boat then, and then we were put on a transport, and they got tired of us there, and they put us on an empty, one of these landing craft, and it runs in and lets the door down, and you rush it. And we got into the Kizzarazza airfield this morning, and some fellow met us there, and he gave us a sweet cap cigarette each, and he asked us if we wanted to fly home. Well, we said, sure. So at 10 o'clock, we were taking off, and we went over Tokyo. You could just see the street lines here now. I mean, nothing was standing there. It was just complete devastation. And we were 8 hours nonstop from here to Guam. That was my first air ride in my life. So anyway, we got to Guam, and they gave us all a medical. And then they told me I had a spot in my lung. Well, that's what I was telling you about when I put it with these Japanese. I must have picked it up. So they wouldn't let me fly, so I had to take an American hospital ship from there. I left there about the 23rd, and we got back to the U.S. hospital ship Restu to Hawaii on the 3rd of October, I believe, to Hawaii, and it was around the 7th or 8th when we got to San Francisco, and we went to a naval hospital there and went through more medical routine, and then we put on a train to Vancouver, and we got back on the 10th of October, 45. I stayed a few days at Shaughnessy Hospital there, and we took a train for Winnipeg, but it wasn't for Winnipeg. They stopped us at Rivers and dumped us off at Brandon Military Hospital. We had to go in by ambulance. And I stayed there 10 days, and then I went over to Nainette Sanatorium, and I stayed there till 17th of April, 1946. Then I went home, and I was on convalescent for a year, and then I went to business college for a year, a little over a year, and I started working for the government, and I've been working ever since. Prison camp one time, I said when he used to carry this excretion out, that these cement vats, cement walled up about that high. Of course, most of it was just, you know, rice hulls and water anyway, from the diet we had. And this cold morning was shivering. We didn't hurry too much, because, you know, if you to kill as much time as you could. And this Englishman, he had the bald head, no hair at all, and he had a big mustache on. And this stuff in this vat had a crust on it that hulls about like that. I don't know what happened, but he kind of backed up like this, and he just went right back into it, down about 6 feet now. And this bald head poked up, spewing it out and wiping on his head. And we were laughing, and the poor beggar's trying to get out of it, you know. And we finally stopped laughing, hauled him out, and he had to go into the camp. This is late October, it's cold. And he had to have a cold shower and everything. And the Japanese medical sergeant thought it was such a big joke that he gave him 3 days rest with full rations.
Were there any particular prison guards that were outstanding that you still remember?
Well, you see, they used to change guards. You know, you'd have guys maybe they might be there 6 weeks, 12 months, and then they'd move. Though I would say there might be 1 in 100 you couldn't corrupt, maybe, you know. I remember once an American broke into the Red Cross supplies right at supper time, and he was just coming around the corner and he ran into a sentry. Well, he got the sentry quieted down and gave him some of the stuff. Just as he was in the process of doing, the corporal came around. Well, that blew it wide open. And they made him stay. There was a sump in the yard about full of that deep water, and they made him stand stripped naked up to the waist there, and he got cramps, so he just collapsed.
Well, do you have any instances of the guard being?
Well, oh, some guys, I mean, they think nothing giving you a bash with a rifle butt or a prod with a bayonet or a kick or anything. I mean, they're paying the thing with slapping you across the face or something like that. I mean, some of them just delighted, but some of them would go out of their way to be merciful. You know, there was just no deviation whatsoever, well, some others wouldn't bother, just like one interpreter we had there. He wouldn't go out of his way to, you know, to get anyone in trouble. Or another one, if he heard one little thing, bingo. Like if you were in the garden, you weren't to steal anything. Or if you ate one pea, you might just eat a bushel. You wouldn't get any worse punishment for it. Well, if the one saw it, he might have just said, hey, watch it. Another one, right in reports, you know, make a big deal of the thing.
What about prison breaks? Was there
anything? No, because there's no place to go. Where would, as I said, you look at where would you go? There's no place to go.
You never heard of any at all?
No. Not in Japan. In Hong Kong, yes, four of our guys escaped when they were shot. And I remember this stupid Englishman, Tim Carew, had wrote this book here. He said they lived to testify at the war trials. They didn't. I read his book too. I didn't read so much crap in my life.
Do you remember the names of
them? Well, it's Payne, Brzezinski, and Morgan. And an Adam. Yeah, they were grenadiers, yeah, four of them. They escaped in August of 42 from North Point Camp. And I tell you the one about the whiskey. We found, well, we had this Irishman, so I don't know whether you should take this or not. We had this Irishman, Sammy Burden. He'd been in the Indian everything, and he knew the army inside out. And this Colonel Sutcliffe we had been in the India too and that, but he was a real bombastic Englishman. They know that if he got enraged, you know, and beat red and that, his orders were orders, and even if he went to hell obeying them, you know, he was supposed to do it. And we were told we were never to talk to these Punjabis, Sikhs, and these Rajputs and that, because you might offend, if you show them a picture of their family, some of them, that's an offense, if you don't know. Well, Sammy knew them, and when we were at this university, they were sitting outside in the rain, shivering, while the Japs guided his machine guns all around. Sammy's talking to this Indian. You know, he squatters down like this, no hat on, and he's drunk. I'd given him a bottle of his teacher's Highland cream we found. But, you know, it's an Irishman that didn't drink whiskey. So, he goes over and he says, come on away, Burden. And Sammy's mother, he says, come on away, Burden, you're drunk. And Burden never moved. He just looked at him. He says, you balloon-faced old cunt. He says, you're drunk to your bloody self. Well, he just about had a heart attack there and there with a rage, but he couldn't do anything. He had to leave. But he went the color of that rose on that doily. I mean, of course, we couldn't help it. We all got a bag on it. You couldn't help it.
How did you find the Japanese and their relations with the Chinese.
Oh, they're very cruel. Very cruel. I have seen Chinese, I've seen them dead in the water, floating on their hands, tied down their backs like that, and paying the stuff to them. And incidents I speak when I personally, and I remember one morning a camp, for no reason at all, a sentry, this girl was just playing along the shore, a girl, she'd be about 12, and he just shot her through the chest, and he slung his rifle on his hand, lit a cigarette, and walked away, just like you'd go over there and take a drink. Nothing of it. And I've seen them too at other time, a couple of Chinese women walking by one time. They took them, beat the hell out of them, and they wired them to a light pole. And they kept them there for two or three days, and then every once in a while they goes and beat the hell out of them. Whether they died or later on, I don't know, but one morning they went there. They like to took them out and finish them somewhere. I mean, cruelty, you had to see, you wouldn't believe it. Sometimes they'd stop a couple of Chinese and they would tell one, well, they'd tell them they had to fight each other, and if one didn't, whichever one lost, they would beat the hell out of them. Nancy, I mean, they'd go out like two bantam roosters.
Did you ever figure out the reason why they were so
close to the Chinese? Well, there's a strong hatred anyway, because I mean, the way they butchered China for years. Now, I remember reading in 37, where in up around Shanghai and Canton, those places where they used to take Chinese prisoners from Java, and they put them in a compound, a big compound, and use them for target practice, then go in and bang them, or tie them together in groups and then throw gasoline over them. Well, I saw pictures of that, and I was talking to people in there, and they said that was no exaggeration. They would just tie them together and throw gasoline over them. Big joke, laugh. But I mean, they were just plain bloody savages. There was no other word for it. I mean, that's the way they were from kids. They were brought up that way, and they'd, of course, when they attacked Hong Kong, they'd been butchering people in China for 3 or 4 years then. I mean, they were well bloodied up. Life didn't mean a thing to them. And I remember another time we were on gravel trucks, and a beautiful Chinese girl, she crossed the road and the truck hit her, and it spun her around two or three times, and the back truck hit her, and it knocked her flat. Well, they stopped, and this little guy got out and kicked her and beat her with his rifle butt and everything. And I remember the next day I went to work, and she's over the seawall. Then they see her leg broke here and the bone sticker, but she's laying dead there in the rocks. Well, I mean, that an arm. He took her out and kicked her up as soon as she'd gone to a hospital. I mean, they were just out and out bloody savages. That's what they were trained to be, and they were nothing more, nothing less.
You speak of using your buying food from time to time. What did you use for bargain?
Well, when we were first taken prisoners, we had Hong Kong money on us. Well, that's when they'd sneak up to the fence, but then after that they completely disallowed it. They wouldn't let you do it. But at the working party, on the work parties, they paid you like 10 cents a day or something. Well, you save, you maybe get maybe a cupful of salt might be 40 cents or something. Well, once in a while there'd be stuff you could buy like that. And some of these people in the camp, see, a lot of them were civilian too, could get some stuff in from outside. There was all seemed to be ways on work parties, you know, sometimes if people get, you know, someone might slip someone something to you. And eventually, they did, one time they paid us, I think, 10 yen each. Well, then they'd bring a kind of little canteen in, and they'd buy a little tin of beans or a little bit of a chunk of brown sugar that's mostly full of grass and gravel and junk, but I mean, it tasted pretty damn good at the time. Things like that you could buy, or maybe a bit of pepper, if you think about it. There wasn't, I mean, as far as others, there wasn't too much you could buy that you really fancied.
How did the men keep themselves clothes?
Well, with whatever you had, a lot of them bartered their clothes off, you see. But when we went to Japan, and we ran into snow. They said, no snow here. Well, then it's early November, you see these flurries in the mountains. The next thing you know, you have that much wet snow some day and that much the next day. But when we went to Japan, it didn't matter what you had. They took it away from you and they issued it Japanese army staff. Little wee hats and everything. You had exactly what their army had. And blankets that would come down sound about here on your mats, you know. And you were just on grass mats. The huts were on reclaimed land. You were on grass mats, elevated on boards about that high off the floor. And they were just boxed in. You had little thin boards on the top, and little about 2x2 studding, and then the paper doors sliding up the side to box you at night. And for stoves, you had the coconut oil can with bricks built around it. You could light it at 5, and it had to be out at 7 o'clock. And out meant out, not a pinpoint, or you couldn't have a fire the rest of the week. Well, you come in the wet to the knees, some of the fellas, no place to dry their clothes and that. Well, they get gangrene in their feet, freeze their feet and that. And they'd have to go out to work again the next morning. And well, that's what killed them. Some of them, like a bar, no socks. Some of them, these Japanese socks were just like ordinary store strings, so were their gloves if they gave you any. But the socks wouldn't be any longer than that. Well, I'd save some socks. I had about 6 pairs of socks. Well, you got some of them wet today. You lay them under your blanket at night and try and dry them out a bit, and you have them for the next day. But I, when we were working out at the nickel factory there, they wouldn't even let you wear mitts if you had them. You're in the kind of hole, so you could have your thumb around your hand, or maybe a bit of rag, or you get them, and they wouldn't let you have it, just to be messed with you.
Did you ever see any, after the battle of Hong Kong
separated
the officers from them,
wherever,
did you ever see any
officers in the North Point? Oh, yeah, and then North Point, we had our own officers with us there all the time we were there.
Was there any set order in the prison camps you were in when this?
Well, you were all allocated to your individual huts, and like you, as an officer, you would be in charge to assemble everyone today. When the Japanese come down for roll call, you have been ready, and tomorrow, if I was an officer, it would be my turn that way. And from that camp, they started working at the airport, digging it up and stuff like that. But otherwise, guys, we're just content that maybe you couldn't read too much, you couldn't play cards too much, because their eyesight is not as good once the lack of vitamins and that started bothering them.
During your imprisonment, did you have any idea of the way the war is going in Europe?
Oh, yes. I mean, I never, all the time I was a prisoner, I can honestly say I never lost track of a day. I've been damn sick quite a few times. I was down to 97 pounds, I've just been in malaria, and then I got a blood poison in my leg once. And it affected my kidney, and I got a blood clot from that, and I damn near died from that. But I still knew what day it was from that. I never lost track of time, but we always, in Hong Kong, we got the Nippon Times, which was printed in English. Well, I mean, anyone with average intelligence could read between the lines. When you saw they had a great sea battle, and they sunk 10 American battleships, and about 5 aircraft carriers, and shot down about 500 planes, and things like that, and they lost a cruiser, and a little damage to an aircraft and about 10 planes. Well, I mean, you just had to use common sense to realize what was going on. Well, we used to get that. In Japan, you weren't like when I was in Kobe, you weren't supposed to have papers, but there was an old Japanese there. He used to come into camp and he used to smuggle a paper into the cooks, and he'd slip them a few extra tidbits, and he used to smuggle them in a paper that was printed in there. But when you saw that way, when they were admitting that American planes were bombing Iwo Jima and places like that, well, especially when you saw raids, like when I was there, and you got 54 raids in February 1945, there was no damn doubt as to what way the war was going.
Well, how did the Japanese information to their own people, the civilians, that they know the way the war's going?
They stick to propaganda. I mean, their own people, they actually treated them worse than they treated us in many respects. I mean, the fact that you were a Japanese, you were supposed to know better than a filthy Westerner or something. It was worse for them to commit a crime than it was for us, because being a honorable Japanese, they were supposed to know better. I mean, the army was just as ruthless on the civilian people as they would be on us at any level.
Well,
we wrote letters. I don't know. I don't think more than one or two of them got home. We wrote letters, I'd say, on 6 or 7 occasions, but I never got a letter until after the war. I think I got 2 letters after the war was over, before we left. One of them had been written in 1942. Where it had been all that time, I don't know. You see, you would write a letter, and then they would take it and go through it, and if they didn't understand any English words, well, they'd ask you what it meant, and you tell them, they didn't have a dictionary in the camp, so rather than admit they didn't know, well, let's set the, I'll interpret it. He's his version, but he'd like to know what yours is. So they say, well, future, you better not use words like that. They didn't like to admit that they didn't know.
Did you ever run into any Japanese with some Canadian background?
There was one here from Vancouver. He was a miserable son of a gun. Kamloops, we call him. His name was Inouye. They hung him for treason. He was raised in Vancouver, and he was mean, just out and out mean. There was no other word for it. And I remember one day an officer asked him, he said, "You've lived in Canada, you know like what people like, and they used to eat good food and stuff. Like, why is somebody mean?" "Well," he said, "when I was in Canada, they called me a yellow slut-eyed bastard," and he says, "now this is sweet revenge." But he just loved knocking people down and kicking them and that, and he had a horrible buck-tooth-looking character. He was court-martialed in the end, and he was sentenced to be hung for what he'd done, and then he told the prosecuting judge, he said, you can't hang me, I'm a Canadian citizen." And the judge said, "very well, we'll hang you for treason," and they did. So he couldn't get out of it. But I've seen Japanese, like some Japanese, if they were caught doing a little favor, like, I'm sure they'd get a terrifying beating, but it wasn't worth it. I remember once being in the urinal, and some civilian, he came in and he just gave me a nudge, and he slipped me a couple of cigarettes. You know, well, it was very nice, but I said it wasn't much, but it was a very nice gesture, just to say. But if he'd been caught doing that, he'd have gotten knocked down, and like that, half his ribs broken, and God knows what else for doing.
How about communication? Many of the Japanese told him they were able to pick up Japanese.
Well, oh yeah, we in the camp, we had to learn Japanese. You had to take your roll calls in Japanese, and in every hut, and there always had to be one man awake. When the lights went out, okay, the first hour you had to be awake. When your hour's up, you woke me up, I took over. And any time a Japanese came along, you had to tell them in Japanese how many were in that hut, how many of the men were in the hospital, how many men were in the cookhouse, or how many men were in the biffy. Benji, they called it. And you told him in Japanese. If you didn't, you got a belt across the head or a sword scabbard or something. And if you didn't say, if you said it and it wasn't quite right, you'd get one anyway. But a lot, quite a few of them spoke a bit, you know, a bit of English, you know, between the two you could communicate. But the interpreters, I mean, some of them, two of them were, had been in the States educated. Well, one of those went to the gas chamber, too. He got back to the States. I know he'd been home visiting before the war, and the war broke out. And anyway, he went back to the States and enrolled in university or something. I don't know how the hell he did it, but he did. But anyway, an American POW saw him on the street one day, and he just said to his policeman, he said, "arrest that man, he's wanted for war crimes." And he eventually went to the gas chamber.
You yourself, what physical effects you suffered from your imprisonment at that time?
Oh, well, I said I had tuberculosis. And, you know, you have lots of things. Some days you don't feel about the eye, your eyes bother to a certain extent, and your joints are dry and crackly, and your stomach, you've got to watch what you eat. Some days you'll eat something, you'll gas to high heaven for days after that. But you get awful, you get tired easy, and like if any exertion will make you break out in a, you know, an undue perspiration, which you normally wouldn't do. And then you will get maybe periods of a month to 6 weeks when you won't sleep worse a damn. And maybe the next 6 or 8 months you'll sleep good.
Have you been to urology?
I've never been admitted to urology. No. I'm due now. You have to go up once a year and have a chest X-ray and that, things like that.
And
what
about pension?
Oh yes, I was discharged with a pension because I had TB or that. They discharged me while I was still at Minette when the Army put me on pension.
And summing up this interview, Mr. Foxhall, what would you be your overall comment on the Hong Kong experience?
Well, my overall comment would be, I mean, in the first place, I mean, it was, we've got to admit, I mean, we volunteered, so you can't complain there, but it was useless standing there. It was like sending someone with a tumbler of water to put out a fire. You had no air force, you had no artillery, and the communications were bad, and if you had 100,000 troops with the equipment we had, you still wouldn't have won. It just tore you down piecemeal by piecemeal. I was going to have sent us someplace else where we'd been on equal terms. But as I said, we volunteered, and some of the poor guys didn't make it in the war, some of them didn't make it after they were prisoners. So I figure any of us that did make it back and are still alive, we've got a lot to be thankful for. And I don't, frankly, I mean, I'll be quite honest, I don't hold any animosity towards the Japanese people. This was the army. They were taught, they were brought up to be butchering savages, and I don't hold any animosity towards the people. We had Japanese girls working in our office. I remember one woman remarked one time, they said, "You better not bring her in, that John Folko wouldn't like." Well, I said, "I'll be the last one to have any complaint." I said, "It's not her fault the way they acted over there." And we've had different ones since. My daughter, her best friend is a Japanese girl. So I'm quite honest, I don't hold any animosity, I mean, towards them. I said, the ones that treated us like barbarians, that was the way they were brought up, and they would have treated their own people the same way if they got in the way. And I don't think that is typical of the Japanese. I mean, they are very industrious, ambitious, and they're a clever race. And even if they're poor, you never see them dirty or anything like that. That's one thing I would say about the Japanese. I never saw a Japanese that you would say were, you know, dirty. Even if they were bone poor, they always look clean and they're always industrious. But they were very proud people, and so I mean, a lot of people I know have not, you hear them give vent to their animosity. But I don't think they use that. I mean, it's water down the drain as far as I'm concerned, and we can't blame women and children, and they took an awful beating too from bombings and that, like Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and that. It's in all wars, I think the civilian population are the ones who really suffer the worst. Well, it was a useless venture sending us there, or whether we could, naturally, couldn't do a lot of good, and if we'd had 100,000, we wouldn't have done any better in the long run. We'd just prolonged it a day or two longer, maybe.